This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
I'm going to share with you some thoughts about the challenges and controversies that we're facing in managing patients with HCC while they're on the waiting list for liver transplantation. So what are the goals that we are trying to aim for in managing these patients on a waiting list? So I think there are three. First, we like to optimize selection criteria and preserve really good post-transplant outcome. And in doing that, we have to balance our intention to maximize the benefit of liver transplant to these patients. And there are still a lot of questions and debates about really the precise role and benefit of local regional therapy become somewhat controversial. Some of the data that came out recently are really intriguing about local regional therapy being the response to local regional therapy being a potential marker for selection of candidates for transplant. We want to look at the impact of local regional therapy on waitlist dropout, post-transplant outcome, and Rio already alluded to this waitlist dynamics. How could we provide equal access to liver transplant for both HCC and non-HCC patients? So this is a slide I've been using for more than 10 years, but it's still good in this day and age. And the Milan criteria that many of you know include single lesion up to 5 centimeters or 2 to 3 lesions, none greater than 3 centimeters. This is still the benchmark for selection of candidates for transplant, at least in the United States. You already saw this, basically the MEL system organ allocation utilized the Milan criteria to give priority to patients with HCC, and the Milan criteria is divided further into T1, single lesion under 2, and also T2. And then you can see that back in 2002, at the time of implementation of the MEL system, there was a really overestimation of the risk of dropout. So these patients are given way too much priority. 90% of patients received transplant within 3 months. So these scores were downgraded to 24 and then now 22 for T2. And patients with T1 are no longer getting priority status for transplant. And one of the primary reasons is that a lot of times when these patients have presumed T1 lesions going to transplant, in the explant you found nothing. You found no cancer. Those are high rate of misdiagnosis. So this is really unfair to other patients who need transplant. So currently, patients who get MELD exception for transplant for HCC, they get upgrades every 3 months while they are on the waiting list. So as Rio Hirose already alluded to, in our region for blood type O and A, the average waiting time is now in the 12 to 15 month range. So they need to go through 3, 4, or 5 cycles of upgrade before they get to the top of the waiting list. So now we have the MEL system, you know, for HCC. So what's the outcome under this system, MEL allocation? So when you compare patients with no HCC, this is a data published a few years back, you see 4-year survival for those without HCC, about 78%. These are patients with HCC receiving MELD exception. You know, they are within T1 or T2. And you see that the 4-year survival is similar, not quite there yet. And if you restrict to only patients meeting T2 minus the T1, this is slightly lower. Even the ones who are not getting MELD exception, primarily because probably because they have more tumor burden exceeding T2 criteria, you know, this number is not bad. I think many people would consider this to be acceptable survival, but now we are setting our bars very high. We want patient survival for transplant for patients with HCC to be the same as those without HCC. So that's kind of the shift in the thinking. We're setting our bars very high. A 5-year survival, 50%, 60% may not be good enough. So across the U.S., not everybody followed the Milan criteria. There are regional variations in the policy, and I think that may be one way to go to approach some of the to make progress in certain areas that are important, including HCC. In Region 4, they use expanded criteria. The criteria very similar to the UCSF criteria, and you can see that those patients meeting the expanded criteria have 3-year survival, very similar to those within Milan criteria. And in Region 5, where we're in, we use the downstaging protocol with the following criteria, and patients who were able to be successfully downstaged to within T2 or Milan criteria, they can get the same priority for liver transplantation, just like patients meeting T2 criteria. So it has worked pretty well for us, and this is based on a lot of work back there by John Roberts back in 2006, so he's taking good care of us. So there's a recent international consensus conference in Zurich that I was part of, and the consensus conference made the following recommendations about selection criteria for HCC in the setting of liver transplantation. So first, liver transplant should be reserved for patients with HCC who have a predicted 5-year survival comparable to non-HCC patients. So we are setting our bar very high. Milan criteria is still the benchmark for selection of patient for transplant, and then modest expansion like the UCSF criteria may be considered because of several studies showing comparable survival, but this is really the key here. Those with worse prognosis may be considered for transplant outside Milan if the dynamics of the waiting list allow this to happen without undue prejudice to other recipients with a better prognosis. Other than the statement about Milan criteria, all the other recommendations were considered to be weak based on the level of evidence presented. So clearly, I think that many of us believe that there's much more to just liver, to just tumor size and number. There are other factors that clearly influence outcome following liver transplant for HCC, and tumor marker is one area that we are very interested in, and a lot is being done. But up to this point, AFP is the only marker that has been shown to reflect tumor biology, and generally the higher the AFP looks like, the worse the outcome. You can see the cutoff here that predict worse outcome is all over the map. It ranged from like as low as 20 to about 1,000. And there seem to be a few more studies that support using a cutoff AFP of 1,000 to predict prognosis. Just very quickly going over some data. In the analysis of very large transplant registry data, a cutoff of 400 seemed to predict worse outcome after transplant, but these are registry data without looking at tumor recurrence. So these data may not be as it lacks some granularity. Whereas in single and multi-center study, a higher cutoff AFP of 800 to 1,000 seems to be more predictive of prognosis following liver transplantation. So one of the key questions that I'd like to ask is, if you want to achieve really good survival, you can use an AFP cutoff of 100, and you'll end up excluding half the patients on the waiting list. So the key question is how many patients you need to exclude to prevent one recurrence. So that's really one of the key questions that we try to answer in the analysis or experience that was performed by Bilal Hamid that was presented last year at the AASLD. So when we look at our own data of over 200 patients, the no surprise is vascular invasion and tumor stage beyond UCSF criteria by pathology because of understaging of tumor before transplant. These are very well-known predictors of tumor recurrence after transplant. And here we see that AFP is a very strong marker for poor prognosis in terms of tumor recurrence, particularly with AFP level over 1,000. And what's interesting is that we found a very strong correlation between AFP and the presence of micro or macrovascular invasion. Vascular invasion is something we can't tell before transplant. So, for instance, in patients with AFP greater than 1,000, there's a very high odds ratio, like 7 times higher probability you would be dealing with the presence of vascular invasion. So it looks like AFP being very high is a poor prognostic marker. When we look at survival without recurrence, those with AFP level at or below 1,000, they have 5-year overall patient survival recurrence of 80% as opposed to 50% for those with high AFP going into liver transplantation despite local regional therapy. So even before we look at this data, we actually came up with this this guideline for exclusion of patients at our center. When we look at this study, applying an AFP cutoff of over 1,000 to patient HCC within Milan criteria, we would exclude about 5% of patients from transplant, and that translates into 20% reduction in the rate of tumor recurrence after transplant. So our policy is that if you have a patient with AFP over 1,000, you need to show a decrease in the AFP to less than 500 with local regional therapy before transplant, before the patient can be activated for transplant. This applies to both Milan criteria and those enrolled into our downstaging protocol. So the next area I want to look at is the wait list outcome based on dropout from the waiting list, because of tumor progression or wait list mortality, not just looking at post-transplant outcome. And this is how local regional therapy enter into the picture. So some basic background information. At our center, chemoembolization is really the workhorse of local regional therapy as a bridge to liver transplantation. And this involved selective embolization of the feeding hepatic arterial supply to the tumor combined with targeted chemotherapy. We're running out of cisplatin now, but this is usually mixed with lipido or gel form particle. You see that this angiogram, feeding artery, and this is a very obvious tumor blush here. And many centers are now moving away from the conventional chemoembolization to using doxorubicin beads or DC beads. And when you look at head-to-head comparison, you know, the difference in terms of tumor response based on objective criteria, it didn't really achieve, as a trend, but not statistically significant benefit in favor of the doxy beat. But there's some difference in terms of toxicity, not in terms of serious adverse events, but liver toxicity based on ALT, AST level, and also systemic effect seem to be in favor of doxy beats, particularly the incidence of alopecia. So a lot of people are moving to the use of doxy beats. And our interventional radiology group, very interesting in looking at some of the angiographic features that help us decide whether a patient would do well with chemoembolization. Just a few examples here. Is a classic hypervascular tumor. You see clear tumor blush. This is a type of patient who would do very well with chemoembolization. And then you see other cases when the tumor is really faint and this feeding artery is very tiny. So in fact, we're able to establish that these are angiographic features that are associated with response measure in terms of achieving over 90% of tumor necrosis in the explant. And these factors include EVID arterial enhancement on angiogram, larger feeding artery at least 2 millimeter, and EVID ethidal accumulation. Now, when you see a patient that probably chemoembolization would not work very well because of these angiographic features, then you go the next step to other options. The options that we often entertain include percutaneous or laparoscopic radiofrequency ablation. And the technique depends on location and also size. The best result with percutaneous RFA is when the tumor is less than 3 centimeter, and some radiologists would argue that you can go up to about 4 centimeter. This is a perfect location for percutaneous RFA. And other locations are not as favorable. For instance, the tumor here is very close to stomach or intestine, so you don't want to burn a hole in somebody's bowel. And here, very close to the diaphragm, the patient would not be very happy if you burn a hole in the diaphragm. So this is not these are not ideal locations. And another situation is when you see a tumor very close to a large vessel, and this would create what we call a heat sink that would really diminish the effectiveness of radiofrequency ablation. Okay. So what do we know now about the role of local regional therapy? I personally really think that there's a benefit, but there's just no level 1 randomized controlled trial that we can do to establish that. So there's still insufficient data to confirm this benefit of reducing the risk of dropout from the waiting list. And there's some sophisticated Markov model analysis showing that the treatment is cost-effective if you are in a position where the patient needs to wait a long time before you get to transplant. And treatment should be considered to slow tumor progression if the waiting time is expected to be at least 6 months, like in Region 5 at our center. So these are the recommendations regarding bridging therapy from the International Consensus Conference. Based on current absence of evidence, no recommendation can be made on bridging therapy in patients with T1 lesions. For T2 and likely waiting time at least 6 months, local regional therapy may be appropriate, and there's no recommendation preferring any type of local regional therapy to others, and patients who have progressed beyond acceptable criteria for listing should be placed on hold and considered for downstaging. None of these are really unexpected, but we are not going to stop here. There's some really intriguing data that may take us a step further, like the response to local regional therapy as a marker of better prognosis and serving as selection criteria. These are two very intriguing studies. The tumor stage was based on either Milan or UCSF criteria. The treatment exclusively with chemoembolization. They have no upper size limits. And the criteria were response based on degree of tumor necrosis by various different criteria, including the RECIST criteria. So in the first study from Innsbruck, Austria, you can see that for patients within Milan criteria, those who show complete response, like complete tumor necrosis, no residual tumor or partial response, they have much better outcome compared to those who continue to show tumor progression over time despite local regional therapy. And for those within UCSF but beyond Milan criteria, those with partial or complete response have outcomes similar to the partial responders within the Milan group, and there's also a trend for worse outcome in those with stable disease or progressive disease. And the next study by this group from Mainz, Germany, look at RECIST criteria to define treatment response and progression, and response was defined as 30% decrease in the sum of the largest diameter tumor nodules, and patients were excluded from liver transplant if they show a 20% increase in the sum of the largest tumor diameter or if they develop new lesions. So the protocol involved 96 patients. Majority of them, this is interesting and unexpected, had tumors exceeding Milan criteria. They observed a very high dropout rate because of tumor progression. And then among those who ended up receiving a liver transplant, about 2/3 show response, and then 1/3 show minimum tumor progression, but not meeting criteria for exclusion. About 1/3 of patients have tumors within Milan, and then about 2/3 were bridged successfully to transplant. So this is the interesting finding, that those who had shown no tumor progression, they have outcome in terms of recurrence-free survival much, much better than those even with minimum tumor progression. So based on these observations and what we have learned from our experience with downstaging, we advocate this ablate and wait concept that was put into print by John Roberts a few years back. The idea is to mandate a finite observation period to observe for tumor biology with local regional therapy, and we probably should incorporate alpha fetal protein in this picture as well. So the idea is whether you have patients within Milan or meeting expanded criteria undergoing downstaging, you want to observe for minimum period of time. The last thing you want is to transplant somebody very quickly if they have a 4 centimeter tumor, even though it's within Milan, but they already have that microvascular invasion. So you want to avoid transplanting those patients. So Rio Hirose already touched on some of the problems we face regarding waitlist dynamics and the inequity in access to liver transplant for HCC as well as non-HCC patients. So there are, you know, many studies that look at perhaps there are factors that predict drop-off from the waiting list that you can tailor your organ allocation policy accordingly. So this is a similar slide, but it's a little bit older, showing that patients with HCC may be advantaged. This is across the board in entire U.S. You see the red bar here is the dropout rate for those with HCC compared to all other patients without HCC and non-HCC patients with initial MELD score under 21. And this is pretty consistent across the board. Of course, we are the exceptions. Here, you know, region 5 is not above, but it's very close between HCC and non-HCC patients. And another study that just came out based on a study by David Goldberg from University of Pennsylvania really highlight the magnitude of this problem across the country. If you look at dropout from the waiting list because the patient is either too sick or died on the waiting list, you can see that there's an advantage for HCC patients at every MELD point they look at, and this discrepancy is even higher for those with higher MELD, HCC MELD 28 versus non-HCC with MELD score in the range of 27-29. So there's a significant discrepancy in terms of the dropout rate from the transplant list. So everybody's saying that something needs to be done. And so several studies have looked at factors that may be associated with drop-off from the waiting list, and the findings are fairly consistent. For instance, the MELD score, higher MELD score, higher AFP, larger tumors, and 3 tumors versus 1 or 2 tumors, these are all factors associated with higher risk of drop-off from the waiting list. Now, Richard Freeman, a few years back, came up with this MELD HCC equation that defines probably a dropout within 90 days of listing. So the 3 factors that were included in this equation were MELD score, AFP, and maximum tumor size. So if you have high MELD, high AFP, larger tumors, you have a higher rate of dropout. However, I'm worried that if you give higher priority to those patients, you know, you're transplanting patients with higher risk of tumor recurrence as well. So it's kind of a rock and a hard place. It's a two-edged sword. In fact, other studies have proven this point. If you look at the outcome following liver transplant for patients who were predicted to have a high risk of dropout based on the MELD HCC equation, in fact, the survival after liver transplantation significantly worse than those who were predicted to have lower risk of dropout. And the same observation for the incidence of tumor recurrence. Those predicted to have high risk of dropout, they have higher rate of tumor recurrence. So we hypothesize that perhaps we can look at this from a different perspective. There may be a subgroup of patients with tumors within T2 Milan criteria have a very low rate of drop-off from the waiting list, and perhaps by identifying these patients, you can give them slightly lower priority. And that's the project that was done by Neil Mater, one of our hepatology fellow this year. So we look at close to 400 patients with tumors meeting T2 criteria listed with MELD exception since 2004, initially 22 points, and we look at the probability of dropout due to tumor progression, and the rate of dropout was about 20% at 12 months. So we apply this ablate because we are a center with long waiting time, so we're looking at ablate and wait. And the response to local regional therapy was being assessed, and also the AFP were also being analyzed as predictors of dropout. This is what we found. For using single lesion 2 to 3 centimeters as a reference point, patients with larger tumors, 2 to 3 lesions, they are at significantly greater risk of dropout than those with single lesion 2 to 3 centimeters. And the lack of response to the first local regional therapy is also a significant predictor of dropout. And then the AFP level after first treatment is also an important factor. The MELD score fell out in multivariate analysis. In fact, the AFP level at many different levels were shown to correlate with dropout from the waiting list. So we came up with this subgroup of patients that we think are at very low risk of dropout. If they have a single lesion between 2 to 3 centimeters, they show complete response with no residual tumor after first local regional therapy and low AFP after first treatment less than 20. So we found that the cumulative risk of dropout in this group of patients is about 1% at 1 year and 1.6% at 2 years. So this accounts for about 20% of our entire cohort. So this is a group that will likely do very well, and they don't really need to be transplanted that quickly. So this is a comparison of the cumulative incidence of dropout from the waiting list. So this is a group that we identify has a very low rate of dropout, 1.6% at 2 years, compared to 27% for all the other patients. So in summary, I think managing patients on the waiting list who have HCC is a very complex issue. There's still many challenges and many problems to solve. In terms of managing them on the waiting list, we advocate allowing at least 3 months of observation period to observe for tumor biology based on response to local regional therapy and also look at the AFP. And the current organ allocation policy should be tailored according to the risk of dropout from the waiting list. Thank you very much. Yes, Kim. That's a good question, Kim. So the question is, if you have a patient who's doing very well, if you feel that, you know, with local regional therapy, and do we need to transplant them? The answer is probably not. But I would suggest that the local regional therapy that you use is radiofrequency ablation rather than just chemoembolization, because the long-term outcome with radiofrequency ablation is better in terms of being a curative type of treatment. Yes, Dr. Allen.
Is that waiting be listed from the time the tumor treated or the time they are listed on the transplant? Because some of us like to take the liberty to treat it, then evaluate them, do all the studies before they send it to the UCSF.
Yeah, so the question is, where do we count time zero? The time listing or time treatment? So, you know, I think we can list patients, you know, because our waiting time is so long, we want to list them and then also observe for tumor biology with local regional therapy. So, you know, we always give them the benefit of the doubt, but then also watch and see how they do. So, you know, I want to emphasize one point is that we like to wait and see how they behave, but at the same time, if you wait way too long, like 15, 18 months, you know, good biology turning into bad biology because, you know, some tumors just can't wait. Yes?
The degree of a differentiation of tumor is not an equation, but we know the poorly differentiated tumors behave much worse than the well differentiated. So I don't know why anybody is studying that.
Yes, actually, that has been, you know, we have studied many factors that predict recurrence, and very often poorly differentiated tumors are just not as powerful as a predictor. You know, it is a predictor, but when you do statistics, you know, in multivariate analysis, sometimes the less strong predictor would kind of fall off. So poorly differentiated tumor is not as powerful as predictor as microvascular invasion. Okay. But you're right, poorly differentiated tumor generally do worse. If I can just tell you that, you know, patient selection and selecting tumors with good biology, when we just look at the downstaging experience, you know, after transplanting those patients, none of those patients had poorly differentiated tumors. They all have well-differentiated and moderately differentiated tumors. So we're really selecting out the ones who had less favorable biology, like the poorly differentiated tumors.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that a lot of centers are still learning about and studying and trying to find a place for Y90. And we're using it. We don't use it as first-line therapy in many cases. We're still sticking with chemoembolization, radiofrequency ablation. But if you have a very large tumor or a tumor with some degree of vascular invasion grossly on imaging, it's not a bad way to start as opposed to, you know, other systemic therapy like sorafenib. So we do use Y90 in selected patients. And in fact, you know, Y90 has been a good treatment to downstage some patients for resection in our experience. Okay, so a lot of centers are now accumulating experience with Y90. Mike. Yeah, that's a really, really good question. I don't have a good answer. So the question is, if you have a 1.6 centimeter tumor, so what are you going to do? You know that, you know, if you think about transplant, you need the tumor to be 2 centimeter before they can get priority points. So we don't have, you know, direct answer to that question, but I can just tell you what I personally would do. If you have a patient who the only reason to think about transplant is cancer, then I would probably, and then there's no other reason. They have good synthetic function, they have, you know, like no ascites, encephalopathy, the MEL score is 6 otherwise. I would consider treating that patient as opposed to waiting until they get to 2 centimeter, because there are a small percentage of cases where, you know, the less than 2 centimeter can become very aggressive over time. So when you wait, and then you can wait a long time before they get to 2 centimeter, and sometimes when they get to a larger tumor, they can start becoming very aggressive. Whereas if you have a patient that you know that had other reasons to be considered for transplant, I'll wait and see if you can get to 2 centimeter and give them priority points. But this is a very heat, you know, very debatable question. Lots of people have disagreements about how to approach it. So that is a great question. Mary, yes. So the question for everybody relates to patients who are predicted to be at low risk of dropout. You know, how should we approach those patients in terms of priority? So I need help with John or Rio on this, but I think that I would give them priority to a certain MELD exception. And then if over time they prove that we are right, you know, they are really doing very well, complete response every single time. Say, for instance, when they get to about 28 points, I'll probably freeze it at that point and give the donors to other patients who need it more, either ACC or non-ACC patients. I don't know how John or Rio would do in that setting.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.